We have epidemics of diet-related disease that are threatening life expectancy, that are going to bankrupt the healthcare system. We need to get out of this egotistical debate about who's right or who's wrong and try to work together with our scientific opponents to come up with a bigger view.
Welcome to the Flippin' Health Podcast, where we turn medicine on its head, flip it upside down, shake it all about, and see what comes out. We're going to challenge convention and change medicine for the better.
Hello, I'm Grant Schofield.
And I'm George Henderson.
Welcome to the
Flippin' Health Podcast.
Morning, David. How's it going?
Good morning. Yes.
So I'm with, David Ludwig. Tell us about who you are and what you do.
Well, it's a great pleasure to be with you in lovely New Zealand, enjoying the weather, relief from a Boston winter. I'm a pediatric endocrinologist and researcher. I'm based at Boston Children's Hospital. I'm affiliated with Harvard Medical School and Harvard School of Public Health. And my work is focused on how diet affects body weight and obesity-related complications independent of calorie content. You know, how can we understand the obesity epidemic beyond just people having trouble controlling their calorie intake and not getting enough exercise?
So can we just go back in time a little bit further? At some point you decided you were going to enroll in medical school. You went to Stanford. How does that even happen, and how did you get interested in medicine, and how you've taken quite a course since there?
I'm the first physician in my family, but for some reason I had, from a very early age, had a calling to medicine and to biology. I remember it was in the fourth grade, and this is before PubMed and internet, of course, walking home from school, my grade school, stopping by the local branch library and having this intense desire, and I have no idea where it came from, to read every book on the shelf on physiology. They had a little shelf, I can still see it, and I went through each book sequentially, fascinated with how the body worked.
As a fourth grader?
In fourth grade. So this was nine years old.
Wow.
Understanding how the heart, the two sides of the heart, and how the circulation went around the body and returned and sent blood to the lungs, and the different workings of the organs. So this was, I just don't know where this came from, but it was like a calling.
And what are your parents saying at this point?
I think they were, I didn't come from a scientific or medical family, but I think I got good general encouragement.
Yep.
And
you obviously did it right at school then, at high school and whatnot, because in your sciences and life sciences, because you had a bit of a head start on.
Yeah, I remember in the fifth grade I wrote an extra, just on my own, not anybody asking me, I wrote an extra credit report on how a virus would penetrate a bacteria, multiply, and cause the bacterium to explode. And the teacher wouldn't grade it. She said, save this for sixth or seventh grade. It's, I don't want to write on
it. Or undergrad, or perhaps postgrad.
So this was truly, for me, a passion and a fascination. And I took different paths through, meandering paths through high school and initially college. Took off a couple of years, knocked about the country, worked as a waiter. And then I remember just feeling all of a sudden this renewed passion and enthusiasm to reconnect with that early interest in biology. It converged. Initially, I had gotten into a chemistry major, but that was a little far away from my interest. So I returned with a clear vision about becoming a doctor. Went to medical school, got involved in a PhD program at the same time, where I was studying.
Right, so that's a pretty big bite to take, right? You're doing medicine, which is no easy task, and then you're getting involved in a research program concurrently.
Well, the nice thing about Stanford at the time was it was both all, this was during a stage of education where we were, the field was trying to rediscover itself. How can education be more effective? Stanford was at the lead of this. So the curriculum was entirely pass-fail and elective. You didn't have to take anything. You didn't have to take anatomy to become a doctor, as long as you passed the suitable subsections of the qualifying tests. But everybody, you know, were at that point, people were so intensively selected that they, you know, didn't abuse that system. And I took extra time, so I went through medical school in 9 years rather than 4 years, getting both a PhD and doing a postdoc at the time.
Yeah,
which really well equipped me for my residency and then a fellowship in endocrinology. So I got interested in pediatrics because, unlike so many adult diseases, I felt were the result of a lifetime of poor lifestyle choices, smoking, alcoholism, and poor diet, resulting in chronic conditions that couldn't be cured anymore, but just were being managed to extend life by a few months or a few years. And I found that very frustrating, whereas pediatrics is at the other end of the life spectrum. Children, no matter how severely they are injured or ill, can undergo miraculous recovery if they're treated right.
Yeah.
And so that became a much more satisfying, both intellectual and personal challenge for me, you know, to be aligned with biology rather than trying to slow down the inevitable for adult. Now, all adult disease is obviously not in that category, and I came around in the last 20, 25 years of my work to understanding how we can prevent diseases, both in childhood but also in adulthood, prevent the kinds of diseases that are now threatening life expectancy in the United States and around the world, related to obesity, diabetes, and heart disease. So there is so much that can be done. But I took a long path through pediatrics and then into endocrinology, and wound up looking at the dietary determinants of chronic
disease. How did the dietary stuff start? Where did you first strike that?
I think I've always been a bit of a foodie. Even as a young kid, was really aware of how I would feel after eating foods of either high or low quality.
But you grew up as a teenager and then an early adulthood right in the middle of the whole McGovern Commission and the food pyramid and the snack wells and the Twinkie, the whole thing.
Well, but back in the 70s, diet wasn't as disastrous as it has become in the last couple of decades in the United States. So we had homemade dinners.
Actual food.
Now, my mom, my parents were very political, and they had, their passion was to change the world and with their work focused on social justice. So my mom, she wasn't by any means the traditional homemaker, but she made sure that we had a home-cooked family meal every night. And if you have that, you're substantially protected. It's, the kids these days who are eating junk food and fast food at almost every meal, and there is no family dinner. People eat in front of the TV.
Yeah.
That's something that didn't really exist when I was growing up.
Mm. So you've probably become most well known, I guess, I don't know if you agree with this, for the carbohydrate insulin hypothesis, the view that there's a hormonal control over appetite and obesity and a lot of downstream metabolic issues. When did that first come to your attention as being something that was worth studying?
Well, as an endocrinologist, so I think...
That's what endocrinologists study, right?
Medical school in the U.S. at least is notorious for having virtually no training in nutrition.
And is that was true when you went through?
Absolutely.
And is it still true?
I think it was like you had a total of 6 hours of nutrition. And while that's egregious on one level, it's also a blessing in disguise because I didn't get inculcated in any, narrow-minded... nutrient-based view of chronic disease. Thinking of nutrients as the nutrient focus is critical for the diseases of undernutrition a century ago.
Yeah. You know,
if you're lacking in, if you've got scurvy,
if you haven't got enough vitamin C,
you need vitamin C.
You're missing vitamin D, and you've got rickets or whatever.
That was a transformative perspective about nutrition a century ago. Yeah. It's useless in approaching chronic disease, especially, you know, the diseases related to obesity. So, I had no bad habits to break around academic nutrition, and instead, as an endocrinologist, I became interested in how food influences metabolism. And endocrinology is all about physiology and metabolism. And so the most dramatic effect of food is on blood sugar, and carbohydrates. When you eat carbohydrate, depending upon how processed it is, how high glycemic load it is, dozens of hormones change. I mean, most notably insulin and glucagon, but many others, incretins, counter-regulatory hormones. And these hormones each have powerful effects on tissue expression and metabolism throughout the body. You can change the expression of hundreds of genes, not based on how much you eat, but what you eat.
What you eat. And that's a very important statement, isn't it, that you just made?
Well, this was an awareness that I began developing in the mid-1990s. The field of glycemic index was just about a decade old at that point. And so certainly protein and fat influence metabolism too, but nothing is as potent and dramatic as the consumption of processed carbohydrates. The body likes to keep blood sugar in a very narrow range. Too low and your brain suffers, you know, coma, seizure, and death. That's a potent selection factor. But blood sugar too high produces all sorts of problems too, chronically.
And so...
So the body has multiple redundant mechanisms for keeping blood sugar in a very narrow range. Unfortunately, and that works really well when people are eating a whole range of natural diets, as has evolved over hundreds of thousands of years in human nutrition. Those regulatory mechanisms get taxed, and for some people, especially with insulin resistance, to the breaking point with highly processed and fast digesting carbohydrate.
It's part of the reason this incretin effect where it goes in, that the plant cell wall is broken, so the carbohydrates absorb higher up in the digestive tract, and now you've got an issue where the carbohydrate is raising insulin, And glucagon is actually raised as
suppressed.
Well, suppressed rather. So you've got a double whammy going on.
That's the point.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it goes beyond insulin and glucagon, but those are the
primary drivers.
Everybody recognizes that carbohydrate raises insulin, but it suppresses glucagon.
And so therefore,
you get a very adverse incretin response. So rather than stimulate GLP, which is further down in the digestive tract, you're stimulating more GIP. And
so you're stimulating the liver to produce its own glucose at the same time that you're ingesting glucose.
Well,
is that what's going on?
Well, high insulin to low glucagon. Glucagon is meant to counterbalance insulin. And if you eat a mixed meal with enough protein, your glucagon and your insulin go up. So the insulin gives you the initial stimulus to store calories, but then the glucagon prepares the liver to release calories a few hours later. That when your blood sugar begins to drop, your liver rescues you and you don't crash. But with a very high carbohydrate processed meal, your glucagon is suppressed. And so that's a metabolic double whammy. That's a term I sometimes use, which is... The nutrients of this fast digesting meal get rapidly stored away in the liver, muscle, and fat. The liver gets also programmed to increase de novo lipogenesis.
Yeah.
That's how you make fatty liver in a goose.
Yeah.
You know, you don't feed it fat, you feed it processed fast digesting carbs. And so the grain becomes the substrate and the insulin becomes the signal. And there you have it. A lot of tests of satiety and food effects are conducted 1 hour after eating. And that really misses the boat, because 1 hour after a breakfast of a bagel, fat-free cream cheese and orange juice, you're feeling great. Your blood sugar's high. Your insulin is working well. Your brain is being well-fed. That's not the issue. It's what happens at 3, 4, and 5 hours. But
and there's a difference happening now between different metabolic states. Tell us about where that.
So you go from too much to too little. You know, you're under the persistent effects of high insulin and suppressed glucagon. Your body is still storing nutrients, even as your stomach has emptied, your gastrointestinal tract has emptied, is no longer delivering substrate.
It's now storing nutrients that you haven't got.
It's trying to store nutrients, and the influx from the gastrointestinal tract is tailing off. And so the concentration of calories in the blood, and we've shown this in several studies, and we have another that's submitted that looks at this. It's quite clearly demonstrates this effect, that the calories in the blood, not just glucose, we have to think about probably the main driver is free fatty acids and ketones. So those get suppressed at 3, 4, and 5 hours to such a degree that some people will have an intense counter-regulatory hormone surge. What is that? These are the hormones, the emergency stress hormones like epinephrine and cortisol that rescue blood sugar at times of a metabolic crisis.
Right. So people, everyday person is actually can get a metabolic crisis on a daily basis.
They don't get that far because before your blood sugar crashes, the calories in your blood crash to that extent, you are driven to do something.
Yeah, you're hungry.
You eat.
Yeah.
So that's why, you know, you look in America and they talk about intermittent fasting and time-restricted eating, you know, asking people to go 16 hours without eating. You know, most Americans can't go from lunch to dinner without eating. Right. Look at people driving from, you know, a two-hour commute, unfortunately, sometimes you have in busy cities. You know, the car is stocked with drinks and snacks.
Yeah, right.
So most people can't go from one meal to the next without eating, let alone, you know, 14 or 16
hours. And is that what drives the title for your book, Always Hungry?
Always Hungry, yeah. That's right. And our follow-up, Always Delicious, which is the cookbook. Which is not to say that intermittent fasting or time-restricted eating are bad, but it is to say that before you engage in those advanced practices, we need to retrain our fat cells. That's the subtitle of my book, Always Hungry. It's part of the subtitle. And we need to take the body out of this hyper-anabolic state. Because, again, after that bagel, fat-free cream cheese, and orange juice that we were told to eat through the low-fat years, you know, you go from too much at 1 hour. So your calories in your blood, your anabolic state is too high.
And loads of whisked away and stored.
And then at 3 to 5 hours, if you make it that far, you go to the opposite extreme. So it's always, it's your body's in effect going from feast to famine multiple times a day. That in most people will drive hunger and food intake, will slow down metabolism, or at least in some people it will. And in others, even if you don't gain weight, that can't be good for your arteries, you know, for your kidneys, you know, for your brain function. Yeah.
But there's a way around this, right? You can get what you call fat adapted.
So early, yes, that fat adapted. So early, going back to my early stages of my career, I became interested in this challenge. And that simply without needing to go to the extreme of a very low carbohydrate diet, just shifting from highly processed, high glycemic index carbohydrates, you know, the white bread, white rice, potato products, the chips, popcorn.
To a better quality.
Sugary drinks, sugars. Going from those to less processed carbohydrates. So, of course, the non-starchy vegetables, legumes, whole non-tropical fruits, which, as you said, allude to it earlier, the sugar, an apple, is still sugar.
Yep.
All of the calories in an apple, essentially, is sugar.
But it's harder to eat the 10 apples than you're getting the orange juice.
One point is, you know, you tend to eat less of it because of the food form and the fiber, but most importantly, the sugar is sequestered within the cellular structure of the fruit, and so that takes a while to digest. So the same grams of carbohydrate can result in much different hormonal patterns based on how rapidly it's digested. So that's where I focused my first 15 years.
Yeah.
And in the last 5 to 10 years, I've become interested in very low carbohydrate and ketogenic diets. I think the first approach is fine on a population basis for people who don't have severe metabolic dysfunction.
And that is part of the population, but not the majority, you would say?
Unfortunately, increasingly in the United States and around the world, a majority of the population has insulin resistance, if not prediabetes, if not frank diabetes. And these conditions are going to be, are going to do best with a more intensive intervention.
So you've moved from which
involves both reducing the, not just paying attention to the quality of the carbohydrates, but reducing them overall and replacing them with mainly with fat.
Right. So you're moving from not just the quality, which is important, but to the
quantity,
to quantity as well. And then there is a discussion often about what to replace that with. And when you mention fat, there's a lot of people, especially in the medical community, who will just go into a bit of a meltdown about that. So what do you say to that?
Stay cool. Stay cool, friend. Let's look at the data. So that's what I'll be giving a presentation tonight on. And I've written a number of reviews, some of which have the title "The Carbohydrate Insulin Model." So my aim isn't to argue that everybody should be on a very low carbohydrate diet, and I actually don't believe that's the case.
Yeah.
I think that nobody will be harmed, and I don't think that other than those whose primary source of income comes from the sugar industry. Other than those, I don't think anybody will argue that the substituting sugar and other rapidly digesting carbohydrates for whole carbohydrates is a bad thing.
Yeah, or perhaps the pharmaceutical industry.
Well, yeah, they fortunately don't have a whole lot of direct say in nutritional guidelines.
Yeah.
But you're right, there's a lot of profit to be made in diet-related diseases.
Yeah.
So I think if we can all largely, as little as 20 years ago, leaders of science of nutrition societies were arguing that sugar was not only benign, but possibly beneficial because it helped you eat less fat, the sugar-fat seesaw.
Why have we got such a short memory on an astonishing statement like that? Why do we forget that so quickly?
Well, I think it's because scientists have egos and professional societies have entrenched institutional protective responses, and it takes a big person to admit a mistake.
Yeah.
They're just, unfortunately, ego tends to dominate too often in the debate. So, but that's the nice thing about the published scientific record. You can go back and look at people's statements. And
but
as little as 20 years ago, 25 years ago, leadership, science, and professional society consensus statements focused essentially exclusively on the importance of reducing fats, all fats, olive oil, nuts, fatty fish. The foods that we now know today are among the healthiest things you can eat. Dismissing sugar.
Can you just paraphrase one of those statements that you showed me yesterday that wasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, one of my favorites is that one group wrote, the evidence intriguingly suggests that it is an increased intake of fat rather than sugar that uniquely promotes overeating. In other words, eating sugar will not lead to overeating. This was the notion. And that was behind the government's call to on the food industry to market thousands of processed foods. Now, we're not talking about fruits and vegetables. Processed foods reduced in saturated fat and total fat. If you're going to do that, if you're going to market something in a package that's low in fat, then what are you going to replace it with?
Yeah.
Well, not beef jerky. Yeah. You're going to replace it with sugar and starch. And that's what happened. And we got the fat-free Snack Wells and the low-fat, and the fat-free half and half cream.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, imagine that concept.
Yeah.
And the reduced fat peanut butters.
But part of your argument here
and
is that
the notion was those foods are going to protect against obesity.
And the government was calling for that reformulation.
The government specifically called for it,
yeah.
In large part because the nutrition community was saying that these foods are going to spontaneously help people eat less. Now, it's become fashionable to blame the obesity epidemic and the mess of the food system during the peak of the low-fat years, on manipulative food industry that's, you know, and a gullible public. But that is a bit of selective amnesia, which I think unfortunately disregards the substantial responsibility that our profession
has in that problem.
And the government had in contributing to that very mindset. So things didn't work out well, of course, and we now know that sugar, based on added sugars, and to the same degree, refined grains and potato products, top the list for weight gain and risk for chronic diseases such as diabetes and heart disease. You know, with trans fat. Now, trans fats were a huge problem. It's the artificial fat made from partial hydrogenation of vegetable oils. But those have been largely removed from the food supply, or they're leaving, other than in some developing countries. And so with those now becoming side issue, that becoming a side issue, it's the processed carbohydrates that are driving metabolic dysfunction. So I think we can all agree at this point, regardless of where you are on the low-fat versus low-carb debate, that reducing processed carbs, if you're eating carbohydrate, and substituting them with vegetables, whole fruits, legumes, minimally processed grains, are going to be helpful. The debate then becomes, what's the total, whether we should focus on just food quality. If you're eating fats, make it high quality fats, although there's debate about that.
Yeah.
If you're eating carbs, make them high quality carbs, same with protein, and let's de-emphasize macronutrient ratio. Whereas the other side of that is if you have metabolic dysfunction, if you're insulin resistant, well, that means that when your blood sugar rises in response to carbohydrate, and virtually all carbohydrates cause blood sugar to rise, that is going to, you know, you're juxtaposing an irresistible force with an immobile object. And that's going to, you know, the logical consequence of that biologically is type 2 diabetes.
Yeah. Which we're seeing.
Oh, which, for which, you know, a third of the U.S. and maybe half of India and China are going to develop. So with the view that metabolic dysfunction is no longer a rare condition, but may represent the majority of the population, we need to now think of national nutritional guidelines as not just directed at those who are optimally healthy, but those who are at immediate risk of these metabolic diseases. And then the question of carbohydrate amount becomes relevant.
Right. So you do have a tension there, that because you've got a population message that you want to apply to everyone around food quality, but then you've got a subset of the population that quantity of carbohydrate may also be important, but actually we might be increasingly coming aware that that could be actually a majority of the population.
Yeah, so I think the way I would approach it is that I'm not by any means recommending that we stop planting grains and stop enjoying fruit, ripe fruit in season, and disregard legumes and such. First of all, we need carbohydrates, grains, to feed a world's population of 7 billion and counting. You know, we can shift the food supply to reduce commodity grains and increase healthful fats. That's not going to feed the world by itself, nor need it. If you're young, if you're metabolically healthy, physically active, reasonably thin, you most likely have, unless you have some major genetic predisposition, you have a lot of flexibility in terms of macronutrient ratio. And there certainly have been populations around the world that have consumed grain-based diets with reasonably good health, avoidance of chronic disease. They tended to be subsistence farmers who were very physically active and, you know, had imposed restrictions on total calories. So they might have been hungry, but, you know, they... you know, they weren't going to get fat.
Yeah, and they were metabolically healthy. They didn't have any of these markers of the metabolic syndrome.
That's right. Yeah. But now that the Chinese peasants are moving to the urban centers, leaving behind their physical activity, but taking with them their rice-based high-carbohydrate diets, we're seeing a metabolic disaster developing.
So you've also become known in your work for looking at energy out, energy expenditure as a function of what we eat as well.
So this goes back to the carbohydrate insulin model that you proposed, that you mentioned earlier, which is, let's first start by saying what a model is. A model isn't, a scientific model isn't the truth. Model is something that you build intellectually to help explain phenomenon that you observe as best as possible, resulting in an ability to predict what will happen under theoretical circumstances.
And that model, you could discard bits of that model and you could build new bits, and that, so, that would be the scientific process.
You know, models aren't static. Yeah. And they're, you know, if for models of, no model of any complex biological phenomenon, and obesity is, of course, in that category, you know, can be absolutely true and static. If that were the case, it wouldn't be very useful. It would mean that everybody agrees and we don't need a model anymore.
Yeah.
A model provides a theoretical infrastructure for making predictions, designing experiments, so that we can advance knowledge in a meaningful way. Yeah. The carbohydrate insulin model is not just about carbohydrate and it's not just about insulin. It's a way of understanding why rates of obesity continue to rise among genetically stable populations.
Yeah.
Why, you know, if it's just a question of eating less and moving more, why should genetically stable populations continue to gain weight? Are we suddenly losing our willpower and succumbing to temptation?
Yeah.
You know, is our moral fabric suddenly unraveled? So we know that biology controls body weight as much or more than willpower over the long term.
Yeah.
And so the carbohydrate insulin model has argued that we've got it in reverse. Overeating doesn't cause weight gain long term. Yes, you can, of course, overeat for a few days or a few weeks and gain weight. But in the classic overfeeding studies, when volunteers were force-fed 1,000 calories a day, after a short while, they'd lose interest in food, and their metabolism would speed up in the body's attempt to get rid of those calories.
And they would return to the original weights.
After the force feeding ended, they didn't lock in at that higher weight. They spontaneously came back down to where they started.
So there's a couple of... There's one prison experiment that was done in the 70s in the US. I can't remember the name of the study, but they...
Yeah, well, there was the starvation study. So it works in both directions.
Yeah.
When you underfeed a human or an experimental mouse, you can change weight temporarily, but the body pushes back so that you wind up coming back to your starting weight for the most part. And that's the notion of a body weight set point. But what that notion doesn't tell us anything about is why people are getting heavier and heavier. If we have a set point, why is it shifting up year after year?
Yeah,
and that's what the carbohydrate insulin model proposes. That it's not that overeating makes you gain weight over the long term. It's the process of gaining weight, of getting fat, that drives overeating and lowers energy expenditure. So a simple analogy would be a pregnant woman.
Yep.
Well, a pregnant woman is hungry, she eats more than usual, and her fetus is growing. But which comes first?
Yep.
Does the overeating make the fetus grow, or does the growing fetus make the mother hungry and overeat?
Oh, well,
it's the second, of course.
In that analogy, it seems perfectly obvious, and it's utterly implausible that you'd say anything different. Yet in obesity research and practice, we say the opposite.
Yeah, an adolescent boy going through a growth spurt might consume 1,000 calories more than normal. But is it the overeating that's making him grow fast, or is the growth, fast growth, making him overeat?
Yeah, and
we can show the simple answer, the simple proof of that is, you know, you're over 20.
Yeah.
You can eat all you want. You can eat an extra 1,000 calories a day. That's not going to make you grow any taller. Yeah.
And you have, but you've now got less testosterone and less growth hormone and these things that you had before, and those were just hormonal issues.
So based on this way of thinking, we can see that the action could be at the adipocyte, at the fat cell. So if the carbohydrate insulin model holds that something, and in this case, mainly it's the high insulin to glucagon ratio, produced by our high-carb diet. So that triggers fat cells to take in and hold on to too many calories, so there aren't enough for the rest of the body. So the fat cells feast, the rest of the body starves, and we're always in a catch-up game there. We try to eat to keep enough calories in the blood, but they're being siphoned off into the fat cells. And so that's the reason that we tend to be hungry, even if we are 50 or 100 pounds overweight. There's plenty of calories stored in the fat cells, but they're locked out. Mm. The cupboard is locked, and the calories can't get to where they need to be to fuel our metabolism, which is the brain, the muscle, the liver, the rest of the organs.
And so why is this still in dispute? Because in animal models, this can be clearly shown. In your own human work, which I think I first read about, I think it's your 2011 or 2012 JAMA study, and your more recent BMJ work, that's still seen as unconventional.
Well, I think that in animals, aspects of the carbohydrate insulin model have been really strongly supported. You know, we did a study we published in Lancet in 2004. Lancet publishes very few animal studies, but they thought that this has had special relevance. And just by changing the glycemic index. Now, there are a number of studies in rodents that dump in a lot of saturated fat into the diet. And, of course, that's going to lead to weight gain because rodents aren't adapted to eat a high-fat diet. And saturated fat, per se, is highly inflammatory in the rodent. It activates toll-like receptors. So these studies are very gross and aren't good tests of the carbohydrate insulin model. A much better test is just keeping the rodent's high carbohydrate diet the same, just shifting from low to high glycemic index carbohydrate. Mm. And when we do that in our Lancet study, a number of key predictions of the carbohydrate insulin model were easy to demonstrate. First, that the animals became hyperinsulinemic. Same calories, same carbohydrate, but the fast-digesting carbohydrate produced primary hyperinsulin.
And did you measure insulin and glucagon both concurrently? We measured
insulin. We didn't measure glucagon in that study, but elsewhere it can be shown.
Yeah.
And then we know that the fat cells then become anabolic. Yeah. So they start, their molecular biology changes. They become bigger. They become better at storing fat. And then at around 7 weeks, metabolism starts to slow down in these high glycemic index animals. How do we know that?
Yeah.
Because on the same amount of food, they start gaining weight excessively.
So that's interesting, isn't it? Exact same calories, but they're gaining more weight.
Which means that their metabolism is slowing down.
Yeah.
And then, these are predictions of the model that are being fulfilled. And then when we limited the food intake to prevent excessive weight gain, right? That's what you're supposed to do if somebody is developing obesity, right? You limit calories. We did that. It's very hard to do in a free living human, but in an experimental rodent, it's easy to do. You limit the calories to prevent weight gain. And despite consuming fewer calories, they were actually fatter. So at the same weight, the high glycemic index animal had 70% more body fat and thus less lean tissue.
Yeah.
Now this observation, which was very dramatic, the animals looked different, just you could see them. They were shorter and fatter at the same weight. Defies the calorie in, calorie out mode of explanation of obesity. So I think that there's strong evidence from properly designed studies in animals. The question is, does this occur in humans? And that's a much harder question to answer. because of the complexities of human research. You can't lock up humans for 5 years.
No, but you don't
give them control.
So it's going to take.
I just want to say it's going to take many studies. No one study can ever prove or disprove this model, despite the claims from some critics. Yeah. Now, we don't complain. We don't claim that the supportive studies we've done are proof. Although there's a tendency among critics to claim, like one critic did a 6-day study with 19 people. 6 days.
Yeah.
And anybody in the low carb movement knows that after 6 days on a low carb diet,
you're just transitioning.
You're adapting. Yeah. Your body takes a few weeks to adapt to changes in nutrients. So, you know, the claim was that falsified. That was the term used. Falsified.
It was definitive proof that you were wrong.
The carbohydrate insulin model. No, that's nonsense. It's hyperbole.
Yeah.
You know, what we need is long term, well controlled studies from multiple groups addressing the question in different ways. You know, you can, one way of doing it is to control calories and let body weight and metabolism fluctuate freely.
Mm.
Another way is you can control body weight and let calorie intake fluctuate based on what people want to eat, or, you know, what you need to control body weight. So we're doing both kinds of studies.
At what point do you stop doing those studies, though, and go on to something else?
Well, you know, you stop doing the studies when we have a sufficient body of consistent, high-quality research that, you know, if not everybody, at least objective scientists can say, yes, this is now clear. These hypotheses have either been, you know, strongly supported or disproven.
Yeah.
And based on whether they're supported or disproven, you either modify the carbohydrate insulin model or you abandon it to something else. Even models that are flatly wrong can be very useful to science.
And they progress. That's the way science progresses.
Absolutely. And unfortunately, this debate has become far too personal. You know, there's too much ad hominem attack around this.
Are you surprised about how that it has played out?
You know, social media can be really disheartening to see how scientists with differences of opinion can go after each other in a very personal way. That's not what science is about. That's what ego is about.
Yeah,
science is about a very different process. And, you know, you want to look at the conclusion of an abstract or a discussion section, you know. We need some humility here. Just because we did a study doesn't mean it's better or more important than the hundreds or thousands of other studies that have come previously. We need to understand how our study, with its strengths and limitations, fits into the big picture. And you know, I think that's one thing I felt. You know, I do try to keep in mind. You know, certainly some journals like flashy titles and conclusions, but you know, I've made a point of, you know, never claiming that any single study of mine or from any other group is proving of anything. You know, we did a recent study, the largest feeding study ever done of the carbohydrate insulin model, 164 people who first lost about 10% of their weight.
This is your BMJ paper.
Right,
yeah.
BMJ 2018.
Yeah.
First lost 10% of their weight on a run-in diet, and then we put them on 20, 40, or 60% carbohydrate intake to maintain that weight loss for 20 weeks. You know, not 6 days, 20 weeks. And we fed them more or less to keep their weight the same. So if your metabolism was speeding up, you would need to eat more.
Mm.
And if your metabolism was slowing down, we would have noticed that based on their weight change and fed them less. And the findings based on doubly labeled water is that metabolic rate was 200 to 280 calories faster on the low-carb diet than the high-carb diet. That's the effect size that we predicted.
Yeah.
Now, doubly labeled water could have methodological problems. You know, one critical group said that, you know, the methodology isn't valid
Oh, so that's suggesting you're detecting an effect that wasn't there.
Yeah,
because
the methodology was invalid. Now, it's interesting that those concerns about this gold standard methodology weren't really raised to criticize previous studies. It's, you know, really when the findings are provocative and that conflict with a current paradigm, that suddenly this gold standard method is suspect. But there's nothing wrong.
It was in the range, though. You've seen in other studies where you carefully measured energy expenditures in different ways, yes, including in direct colorimetry, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, these are all, all of the methods are indirect calorimetry, but there's different ways of doing it. You know, there's nothing wrong with raising criticisms, but we just want to, you know, not impose a double standard where we hold our own research to a much lighter standard than we do our critics. That's a human tendency.
Yeah.
It is unfortunate. But in this study, we went back and looked at food intake, and we found that not only did energy expenditure increase, but the amount of food that we had to feed people on the low-carb diet was also increased by about the same amount, 200 to 300 calories a day. Now, there could be errors in that, too. Measurement of food intake is an imprecise science.
But it cross validates in some ways that's what you're arguing.
That's right. So I would, you know, this second analysis of the food intake is under review at a journal. And it'll, you know, when it comes out, I think that it will be another opportunity for both supporters and critics to reassess the data. It's not going to be proof, but hopefully it will inform the design of future studies that will begin to move us closer. Look, let's come back to the bottom line here. We have epidemics of diet-related disease that are threatening life expectancy, that are going to bankrupt the healthcare system. We need to get out of this egotistical debate about who's right or who's wrong and try to work together with our scientific opponents to come up with a bigger view. I mean, this is a classic concept: thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. You know, it's through constructive debate with our opponents that science advances. We've got to, anytime we make it personal, we produce distractions that lead us away from science and lead us away from addressing these critical public health issues. As a physician, I've sat with families that are being decimated by chronic disease. I've seen this. So that's a sobering fact. Yeah. Whenever, you know, I've got an ego just like anybody else, but whenever it starts to run away from me, you know, I can always remember, you know, that the pain of my ego in being, you know, in whatever scientific debate is going on pales in comparison to the pain of a family that's wrestling with the complications of type 2 diabetes.
And the sad thing is, in the nutrition community, is that there is actually widespread agreement on a whole bunch of issues. And there's discussion about some other issues, but we don't concentrate on some of those agreements sometimes.
Yeah, I think that's right. It's important to focus on common ground, and that I'm leading a new, as an editor at AJCN, American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, I'm leading a new series, which we're all very excited about, which is called Great Debates in Nutrition, where we take opponents on hot-button topics in nutrition, like one that we're developing is debating the proposition saturated fat should be reduced as much as possible to reduce chronic disease. And so we're taking one person on each side of that. They each make their case. Then the other has a chance to respond. And then the original ones have a chance to rebut the response. So it goes back and forth three times.
Yeah.
And then we have them work together on a consensus document. What are the areas of agreement? And we'll always have some area of agreement, you know, even if it's small. What are the persistent disagreements even after this back and forth? And what is a research agenda so that we can resolve these disagreements and not be having the same debate 10 years from now?
And there may be things that aren't either agreements or disagreements that they both just go, we don't know this.
Well, that's an agreement.
Yeah, I guess that is an agreement. We don't know anything about this. Yeah, that is an agreement. Yeah, that's cool. Okay. Thanks, David. I just want to finish with five quick questions that I ask all my guests. First of all, what's good about the health system? You've worked on it.
Yeah. Well, the Western health system is incredibly good at many things. You know, if you have an acute illness, like pneumonia or meningitis, a broken arm, appendicitis, you know, 100 years ago, you might suffer or die from these conditions. Yeah. And, you know, if you get to attention in a timely fashion, you know, these acute illnesses can be well treated and cured.
Well, I'm surprised just talking to you about just recently, there's been some poor people caught on a volcano in New Zealand as it erupted, and they've terribly burned these people, 90% of their bodies. And I remarked to you that how that were going. You said, no, this is the sort of thing that with intensive treatment, it'll take a long time.
You know, I mean, it's a terrible tragedy from this, you know, these burn injuries from the volcano in New Zealand. But even people with severe burns over much of their body, you know, may be able to survive in ways that would never have been possible before. We have to add to that is that there is tremendous economic and social disparities in healthcare delivery in the United States.
So some of these, in many countries.
So some of these, much less so in New Zealand, unfortunately. But some of these miraculous, you know, some of these wonderful, miraculous, life-saving treatments aren't equitably distributed, and you have some very disadvantaged families who may suffer and die from lack of very simple treatments when, you know, the privileged get elaborate treatments for relatively minor conditions.
And that pushes us into whole different political spheres. We probably won't get into that discussion now, but that's an issue.
But when we look at the tremendous accomplishments of Western medicine, we have to, I think, at the same time understand that, you know, the delivery of healthcare is a linked issue, and that, you know, are we distributing the fruits of medical research equitably?
Yeah, right. And so that's one, I guess, the answer to my next question, what don't we do well, and one's equity.
Yeah.
And the other, I guess, is one you've already talked about.
Chronic disease. Yeah. So we are very, very bad at treating chronic disease. The model is largely disregard lifestyle because it's too hard and it's not reimbursed, and instead rely on drugs, an ever-increasing, ever-powerful array of drugs and surgery to treat diet-related diseases.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, you know, this is not a model that is going to lead us to reversing the epidemics. It's just temporizing the problem.
So, and let's grab hold of one of those facts that I think I heard you say. So in the US, you're not reimbursed for giving lifestyle treatments around chronic disease.
No, I wouldn't say it quite that way, but the reimbursement for like dietary counseling is very poor.
Yeah.
You know, you get much better. The incentive is to do things. You know,
prescribing
a drug takes, you know, 1 minute.
Yep.
Surgical procedures are highly reimbursed.
Yep.
So we need, and we know that just sitting with a doctor, even if a doctor had the training to provide nutrition counseling and the wherewithal, sitting with a healthcare professional for 30 minutes every 6 months is not sufficient. Lifestyle is challenging to change. We need, you know, we know that, for example, bariatric surgery, we're willing to invest $25,000 to $50,000 into the procedure, into perioperative care, and then long-term care. Well, where's the equivalent intervention in intensive lifestyle?
Okay, so we're going to invest $10,000 in your intensive lifestyle intervention with you and your family. Your hypothesis that, you know, could make a significant difference.
If we could prevent diabetes, then an investment of $10,000, or frankly even $100,000, would be an excellent one.
Yeah.
And so part of that is we have to have the right resources. We have to understand behaviorally, psychologically, environmentally what's required to change lifestyle, and we have to have the right targets.
Yeah.
You know, we missed, in my view, with the low-fat diet. The idea was just decrease fat, eat as much processed carbs and sugar as you want, and you're going to get there. So you can have the best lifestyle intervention. If you've got the targets wrong, it's a waste of time.
Yeah, right.
And you can have great targets, but if you don't have the right supports for families to make changes in the real environment, you're just not going to get there either. So you need both.
So what do you do on a daily basis to keep healthy?
Yeah, I know that for me, increasingly as I progress through middle age, eating well and being physically active and getting sleep, and frankly, the last one is the most challenging for me, lead me to feel better, be more patient and loving to people in my life, and be more productive and happy. So eating well is
which is the whole goal, right? All of those things.
I think that's those. You know, these are all synergistic goals.
Yeah.
You know, eating well is easy, but I have to say that, you know, this is my sort of my life's interest, and I'm married to a gourmet natural foods chef, which doesn't hurt.
Yeah, it would be awkward if you're a professor of nutrition, professor of pediatrics, and married to a gourmet chef, real foodie, to be unable to take care of that part of your life, wouldn't it?
Yeah, so that, you know, and physical activity to me is self-promoting, is just self-propagating, because I just feel so much better. I don't get out of bed at 6 a.m. And work out because I'm trying to control my weight or because I'm trying to reduce my heart disease risk factors. I do it because I feel better.
Yeah.
And here is a key, I think. We've got to find the synergy between diet and physical activity. If people aren't eating well, they're not going to have the fuel to support physical activity.
Or even the propensity to move. Would you go that far?
Well, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
They're going to feel too tired.
Yeah.
And uninterested, and they're going to try to get, you get on the Stairmaster, or you get on the bicycle, or you get outdoors, and you just tire too easily. So
yeah.
We have to work on nutrition together with physical activity. When you get the nutrition down, then the physical activity becomes more spontaneous and more enjoyable. In fact, we saw that in some of our animal research studies. Those on low glycemic index diet spontaneously become more physically active. They move more.
Yeah.
So physical activity and then sleep, that's a tough one.
And that's the one you struggle the most with.
That's the hardest for me.
Yeah.
And that's probably linked to the fourth. There are five things, you know, diet, physical activity, sleep, stress reduction, you know. That's important for so many people, whether it's, you know, just classic meditation or yoga, or just taking a 10-minute walk in the woods if you're lucky to have woods around you, or you know, listening to music, what have you. And then the last is community. We need social support to accomplish these goals. Getting outdoors, getting physically active is easier if you've got a friend who's you've committed to doing it with at 6 a.m.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just you getting out of bed on your own.
Yeah.
You're accountable to your friend, but you're also looking forward to seeing your friend. And so that jog is going to be... You know, so food, physical activity, sleep, stress reduction, community. You know, we've got to keep those five things.
And those are your messages for anyone out there.
Of course.
Yeah. Dr. David Ludwig, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
And that's it. Thanks for listening to the Flippin' Health Podcast.
This podcast is brought to you by Precure. Prevention is cure. If you enjoyed this podcast, please like and subscribe. If you know someone who could benefit, please share it with them. Together, we can change medicine for the better. Change medicine for good.